Lessons from a Dysfunctional Family, an exposition of Genesis chapter 27, verse 41 through chapter 28, verse 9. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Sunday evening, October 11th, 2009.
I have to admit that I have gotten to the point in my life where very little surprises me. I used to get shocked by things, but that stopped a long time ago. I really, not much happens that shocks me anymore. I found that the older I've gotten and the more that I've experienced, the more that I've seen, the more jaded I've become. So nothing really shocks me much until I'm watching television. And then I see some commercials. I don't watch the show, and I hope you don't either, but I've seen the commercials of the Jerry Springer show. My best friend is my mom's boyfriend on the next Jerry Springer show. That kind of thing. I mean, it's just weird stuff, bizarre stuff, and yet that we're told that's just normal life. We're told this is what life's like out there in the real world. And that's not really new. That kind of thing has been moving that direction for a long time. Because I remember 30 years ago, do you know what the picture of the year was in 1980? It was a movie called Ordinary People. The most depressing thing I've ever seen in my life. The movie begins where just after the oldest son had died in a boating accident, through his own foolishness, he fell out of this boat and drowned. His younger brother is racked by guilt because he was with him, and so the whole movie he's just getting worse and worse, can't cope with it. His mom's domineering, his dad's just this weak character that's kind of in the background all the time. And when you get to the end of the movie, the youngest son tries to commit suicide. Dad walks out on the family, and we're told, just ordinary folk. Just everyday people. This is real life. This is what it's like in the real world. I couldn't identify with it at all. Because I really did grow up in the Cleaver home. It was Leave It to Beaver in my house. The worst thing you could do, you knew you were in real trouble if you messed Dad's good shirt up. The kind of thing I worried about was my brother saying, boy, Dad's going to kill you because you messed the shirt up. That's what I grew up with. So I couldn't identify with these ordinary people. I couldn't identify with life in the real world. It had little or nothing to do with my experience whatsoever. That was 30 years ago. It's become increasingly worse. So now the buzzword that we hear everywhere is dysfunctional. Oh, it's really not his fault. It's really not her fault. You see, they grew up in a dysfunctional family. You don't understand. They have situations in their home. They have things that have happened in their life. And it's really not their fault. It's this dysfunctional family that they had to live with. Problem is that in that worldview, no one's responsible for anything. It's always someone else's fault. Well, I've got news for you. We all come from dysfunctional families. We all have people in our families that do weird and stupid stuff. We all have people in our family that do horrible and awful things. We all have members of our family, whether it's immediate or extended, who say hurtful, derogatory things. We all grow up in that kind of environment, and it's not just us, it's been that way a long, long time. Why? Because families are made up of people, and all people are warped by sin. And because of the corruption of sin, and because of sin's working itself out in all of our lives, in the family group that we form, we all grow up, we all live in, we all have to deal with dysfunctional families. And it's not new, it's been around since the beginning. Do you remember Cain and Abel? Do you remember the first family? Do you remember what happened in that family? It's been around a long time. It's something we have to deal with. If you were to look up the poster family for the dysfunctional, I think it would have to be Isaac and Rebekah. That was one mixed up, disturbed, and troubled family. You remember they had twin boys? And mom had her favorite, and dad had his favorite, and they were very public and vocal about that. Can you imagine growing up in a home like that where mom's got her favorite, and he's always right, he never does anything wrong, and dad likes this one, and he's always right, and he never does anything wrong, and both of them are constantly scheming. What a home life that must have been. It must have been an incredible home in which to grow up. Yet God had His hand on that family. God was gracious and merciful. And so He sovereignly and providentially directed His history through that family. It's an incredible story. And this evening I want us to explore a portion of it. Our text begins in Genesis chapter 27 at verse 41. Genesis 27, 41, and we're going to read down into chapter 28 and verse 9. Genesis 27, beginning at verse 41. Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to him, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Just your typical average family. Just ordinary folk. But the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah, so she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau conforms himself about you by planning, comforts himself about you by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise and flee to Laban, my brother in Haran, and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away. Until your brother's anger turns away from you and he forgets what you have done to him, then I will send for you and have you come back here. Why should I be bereft of you, of both of you both, in one day?" Then Rebekah said to Isaac, "I loathe my life because of the Hittite woman. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women like these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me?" Then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and directed him, "You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Arise and go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take as your wife from there one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. God Almighty bless you, make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May He give the blessing of Abraham to you and to your offspring with you, that you may take possession of the land of your sojournings that God gave to Abraham." Thus Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Padan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the Aramean, and the brother of Rebekah, Jacob and Esau's mother. Just ordinary folks. The thing that becomes increasingly clear to me as I read the Scripture and as I look at the book of Genesis in particular, the thing that seems to be the dominant note throughout the entire book is the fact that God is sovereign. That God is ruler of all things, that He is in charge. That He's in control of all of history, that history really is His story. He is directing all things to an end that He has already determined. And nothing is going to stop His sovereign purpose. It's clear that the only thing that keeps Him from wiping the human family off the face of the earth is He has chosen to be gracious and merciful. At the point of the story that we pick it up, Jacob, thanks to his mother's scheming, has just stolen the blessing that belonged to Esau. Now we need to do a little background on that. We need to make sure we understand what's going on. God had already declared that the older would serve the younger, which was the reverse of what was the custom of the day. But God declared that's the way it's going to be. That happened back earlier in chapter 25. Why was there this change? Why is it that the older would serve the younger instead of the other way around? Because God wanted it that way. And because God does what He wants to do. As long as it doesn't contradict His character, as long as it isn't a violation of His nature, God will do what God determines to do. And so God declared the older is going to serve the younger. We know that from Romans 9. Isaac sought to defy the revealed will of God. Rebekah remembered what God had said, and so she said, "I'm going to see that God's will is carried out, even if I have to scheme and plot and deceive in order to bring it about." So we got a problem. God said this is the way it's going to be. One says, "I know that's what you said, but I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen." The other says, "I know that's what you want, and I'll make sure that it does happen." We got a real problem. We got a real problem in this family. If you were to go to the dictionary and look up the term dysfunctional, I think you'll find their family portrait there. I mean, this is one mixed up, disturbed family. But as we reflect on the passage, there are some things I want us to pull out of it, some principles that we need to understand. Three of them. First of all, we must understand that God's will ultimately prevails. We need to understand in all things, in all ways, God's will ultimately prevails. Psalm 115 and verse 3 says, "Our God is in heaven and He does whatever pleases Him." So you may not like the doctrine of the sovereignty of God, but that ain't going to change it. You may say, "I'm not comfortable with believing that God's in control of all things when certain things happen. That doesn't comfort me." Still not going to change it. You can't say, "I believe God's sovereign" when everything's going good. "I believe that God's in control of all things over here, but over here, I'm not sure He's got that under control." He either has it under control or He doesn't. If He's sovereign, then He's sovereign over everything, the good and the bad. He's sovereign over the blessing that I'm experiencing, and He's sovereign over the suffering that I'm enduring. If He's sovereign, He's sovereign. In all places, at all times. And it seems to me that the message that is screaming from the pages of Genesis is that God is sovereign, that He indeed is control of all things. You can scheme, you can plot, but you'll not get around it. The purposes of the Lord are secure. And you really need to be careful of that notion that the whole plan of God hinges on your obedience. Don't flatter yourself. Don't flatter yourself by thinking, "You know, I know what God wants to do, but I must allow Him or it's not going to get done." God's will is going to be done with you or without you. Because He is sovereign over all things. Because He's God and we're not. Now, some find that disturbing. Some think, "Well, if that's true, then where's the freedom? I are you saying we have no freedom?" No, we have freedom. You and I make choices. You and I make decisions. And our choices and our decisions affect our life. It affects the lives of those around us. It does affect the world around us. It has a rippling effect. But the bottom line is God's will be done. His purpose will be fulfilled. Yes, we have freedom, and therefore we're responsible. Yes, we make choices, and we make decisions, and we do things, and there are consequences to that. But it will not ultimately change the will and purpose of God. His will prevails. His purpose will succeed. When the story opens, as we read it here a moment ago, mom's at work again. She knows that Esau hates his brother. He's already declared, "The time of mourning's coming." Now that's a nice way of saying, "Dad ain't going to live forever. And when he dies, I'm going to kill you, dear brother. I'm going to take care of you. I may have to wait. It may be a few years. It may be a few months. But the time's going to come. And when I'm free, because Dad's no longer here, I don't want to shame him, I will kill you." And mom decides she needs to take matters into her own hands. She's going to see that God's will is fulfilled. But again, the underlying theme through it all is that history is God's story, and God's will, not the will of man, will ultimately be established. J.M. Boyce says, "The will of God is like an anvil. It is there for us to conform to, just as the bar of metal can be bent on an anvil and thus be molded into something useful. But if you do not want to be conformed to the wise and holy will of God, then it is like us beating a piece of wood against the anvil. It is the wood ourselves and not the anvil that will be broken." The will and the purpose of God is like an anvil. And you can either be molded to it, you can either be bent to it, you can either be shaped by it, or you can stand in defiance against it, but the anvil's not going to change. You will be broken. you will be destroyed in the process. Both Isaac and Esau sought to defy the will of God. But apparently Isaac bent to the anvil while Esau stubbornly resisted. Esau came to hate his brother. In the final analysis, he hated God. Because he despised the blessing of God that was given to his brother. He's saying, God, you should not have allowed this. I will not stand for this. I'll bring it to an end. In other words, Esau was determined to take matters into his own hands. You and I look at the world around us and we see injustice and we see pain and we see sorrow and we're compelled to deny the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. We see the frustration in the lives of those we love and care about. We may be looking at the circumstances of our own life and say, that can't be. How could God allow this? Why would God allow this? I don't believe God would allow this. And in doing so, we seek to set ourselves as God, as author. We believe that we have better understanding than God Himself. Do we believe in the sovereignty of God or not? Is He in control or not? John Newton, the author of the hymn Amazing Grace, said, I read my newspaper each day to see what God is doing in my world. Because of his conviction of the sovereignty of God. So what that means is, every dictator that comes to power, he's there because God willed him to be in power. Now, we live in a country where we're given the privilege of being involved in the political process. So, we write letters, we make phone calls, we cast our ballot. We do all the things that are given to us in the freedom of our nation to see laws enacted, to see people elected, to see things done that we believe to be right. But it doesn't always work out that way, does it? Sometimes a person is elected and we say, I don't understand how in the world that person ended up where they are. I can't believe they passed that legislation. I'm worried about what this is going to do to us. Guess what? It passed because God willed it to pass. But Pastor, that legislation could destroy us as a nation. Yeah, it might. But it came into being because God purposed it to come into being. Because the whole program of God is bigger than the United States. And the whole program of God is bigger than your life and my life individually. And because God is not working for the next 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, but for eternity. And His purpose is His own glory. God's will prevails ultimately. The sooner we learn that, the more comforting it becomes to us. Because it's not a matter that it's fatalism. It's not a matter that it's just, I then blindly follow and just, que sera, whatever will be, because that's just the way it is and I can't change it. It's understanding that the working of the world is in the wise, loving, merciful, kind, gracious, purposeful, and just hands of God. And so ultimately, I trust that God's will is going to be accomplished in the earth, and it will be to the praise of His glory and His grace. It's not a fatalistic doctrine at all. It's not a giving in. It's not a giving up. It's trust and reliance, not on blind faith, but on a loving Father. It's trust in a gracious God. God's will prevails. The second principle I want to draw from this text is to understand that deception produces a bitter crop. Again, Boyce says, the fruits of deception always turn bitter in the mouth. When Jacob succeeded in stealing the blessing, he got more than he bargained for. See, Jacob wanted the blessing because all he could think of was position and wealth and power and influence, and he craved it. He longed for it. He desired it. So he schemed with the help of his mother, and through their scheming, he got it. And he got a whole lot more. He got a life of hostility, hatred, exile, and hiding. None of which he wanted. But it was the bitter fruit of his deception. Psalm 1 and verse 3 speaks of those who are righteous as being like trees planted along the riverbank, bearing fruit in each season without fail. Their leaves never wither. In all they do, they prosper. In opposition to that, we grasp for something in our own way, selfishly and willfully, then we will never fully be satisfied. It will never bring any lasting joy. It will bring joy for the moment only. It will satisfy only for a season. It will not last. Ultimately, we are left unfulfilled, though we got everything we wanted. Some of the richest people I have ever known are some of the most miserable people I've ever known. Because it doesn't satisfy. We tend to think, you know, if I just had more money, I'd be a lot happier. If you're not happy with what you have now, you'll never be happy with whatever you get. You always got to have more. I told you before that when we moved to Masham, and one of my deacons said to me one day about his father-in-law, he said, my father-in-law is not greedy at all. He just wants the land that joins his. So if all you want out of life is that which touches yours, when are you going to be satisfied? Never. Because there's always more to be had. And never satisfied with what you do have. Rebekah and Jacob both got more than they bargained for. Rebekah lost Jacob. See, she said to him, why don't you go away? Why don't you go to your uncle's place and stay there, and when your brother's anger finally dies down, when it's safe for you to come home, I'll send, you can come home. But that's not what happened. As far as we know from the record of Genesis, Rebekah never laid eyes on her son again. We know that he was gone for at least 20 years. And in the meantime, Rebekah died, never to see him again. It's not what she bargained for. That's not what was supposed to happen. She just wanted to secure God's will in her way. Instead, she paid the highest price she could imagine. Rebekah thought it would be a small price to pay for her son's safety. But sin always cost us more than we bargained for. Cost us more than we ever imagined. The writer of Proverbs says, many are the plans in a man's heart, but it's the Lord's purpose that prevails. It's a dangerous thing when we are determined to accomplish the will of God in our own way. A second result is that Jacob, the master deceiver, became the deceived. We read on in chapter 29, he's down at his uncle's and he began to become a person of prosperity, and his uncle cheated him. You remember the story about working for his wife? He worked 7 years to possess the one he loved. He woke up the day after the wedding to find out he pawned off the ugly daughter. He'd been deceived. Cheated. He worked another 7 years to get the one he wanted in the first place. And a lifetime of heartache followed from that. And then there was constant friction. And he was deceived. I have to admit, when I read that story, I chuckle. There's that part of me that says, you know, he got exactly what he deserved. It's true, you reap what you sow. But that's not just true for Jacob. It's true for all of us. The third result was that though he was heir of Isaac's wealth and Abraham's blessing, he was a hired hand in his uncle's operation. So different from what it would have been if he simply had yielded to God's will in the first place. So understand, God's will ultimately prevails. Deception produces a bitter crop. And the final thing is to understand there's a better way. It's the same as we looked at this morning. Obey. Trust in what the Lord commands and obey. Acknowledge Him as sovereign, acknowledge Him as Lord, and walk in obedience before Him. We're not called to be ordinary people. We're called to be extraordinary people. A people who've been touched by grace. A people whose lives are different because the hand of God is upon us. That we're to live differently from the world around us. That we're to be a people to the praise and the glory of our God. Let's learn something from this dysfunctional family. Learn to trust the will of God and to graciously yield to it. Understand that we don't need to deceive and scheme in order to see the will of God prevail. But there's a better way, which is simply to yield and follow in obedience the path that He's laid out for us. Let's pray together.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.